This is Across Divides, a series of stories and experiences from communities across the island of Ireland as they meet shared challenges and consider opportunities for collaboration. Find out more at icommunityhub.org.
I'm Susie Cann, and on today's episode, I'm going to be talking with our guests about how communities are engaging in nature-based solutions, in biodiversity and citizen science, as ways to address some of the pressing challenges across our island. So I'm joined by Karen Dubsky, who is the coordinator of Coastwatch, an education and environmental network of NGOs and universities, and based in Ireland and across Europe. And I'm also joined by Shay Daly, who's a member of the Carlingford Loch community and a volunteer with Love Your Loch and part of the local regional coordination of Coastwatch. And I'm also joined by Miriam Turley, who is the Growing Resilience Project officer working at Social Farms and Gardens, which is a community development charity that specialises in community growing spaces. So we are going to hear from each of you, but it'd be lovely to maybe start and tell us a little bit more about your work. Miriam, we might start with you and to just describe what all the work is about and what the communities are doing that you're working with.
So thanks a million. So like I said, like the Social Farms and Gardens is a community development charity, and I think that that's important. We don't do so much building community gardens or running community gardens. We try to support the communities that are doing it themselves, sort of, so supporting that grassroots up approach. And when it comes to that, we just pretty much do anything that we think that the communities would like. So we would do networking between community garden projects. We would do training events depending on what we think people need. Then we would also run sort of projects around specific themes, like around seed saving, for example, or sort of fruit tree growing. And then we would do some work with councils and local government around policy issues as well. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you. And Shay, you're also on the ground in the community, and maybe you'd give us a sense of how did the project that you're working on now start, and what is it that you're doing, and who else is doing it with you?
Yeah, well, there's it started all for me. Thanks for having us anyway. The pleasure to be here. It just started, we just noticed there was a problem, especially in Carlingford Loch, a lot of environmental issues, and they weren't being addressed. And for me, it was sort of like you could see the problems, whether it was plastic or whether it was sewage coming into the lake, whether it was one thing or the other, or industrial problems. Everyone could see the problem, but nobody was saying or doing anything about it. It was just walk on by, none of my business. And there was this sort of mindset in Carlingford Loch, it's nothing to do with me, we don't own it, it's not ours. Oh, it's them ones on the other side, it's them ones on this side. It's their ones, it's their problem, it's their problem, it's his problem. But at the end of the day, it was all our problems. And what we went about doing was setting up a little organisation, Love Your Loch, myself and a few others. And I have to say, credit has to go to every single volunteer that attended a Love Your Loch event. Because without them volunteers, it wouldn't be successful. So it's to do with everybody, from the smallest to the all our little eco bees and our warriors and what have you. So it was just about seeing a problem, fixing the problem, and then going to the source of the problem. And it just led from one thing to another, from single-use plastic to seal rescues to bird watching to coast watch surveys, coordinating different events all around Carlingford, not just in Mourne Point or not just in O'Meath, Carlingford. We decided to include the whole loch, which was a mammoth task because it's a big area, but the success and the reward is seeing the improvement that is happening day by day and just creating awareness. So that's basically myself.
Great.
Yeah.
Karen, you get to be aware of many projects, I imagine, like Shay's. What does all of the work that you do bring to it, and particularly this term, citizen scientists, how would you talk about that, and why is that an important ingredient?
It's a really important ingredient of modern decision making. In theory, the public can participate. You know, we're all talking about access to information, public participation, less about access to justice. But what do the citizens have to bring that they feel confident that they have enough information that they can contribute? So citizen science, to me, it has many different parts, but one of the parts is to have non-scientists understand scientific data which is relevant to them. Say it's your bathing water report or the monitoring under the catchments, you know, all island approach to water management. But quite often people don't know what does 50 milligrams per litre nitrate mean. So it's to get that across. So we do, for example, in one of the citizen science projects I'm involved in is the Coast Watch Survey, where we do a basic eco audit of the shore, as you can see here, every autumn. And we all use the same method, the same base questions across Europe. Well, it used to be across Europe. Now it's only little patches here and there. But the citizens do it like you're checking your house before guests come. It's a methodical check what needs to be done and report. And then with modern technology, of course, reporting is so easy. Virtually everyone has a phone. You know, we used to do everything by hand. So you report that back and then you can put all these little pieces of jigsaw of what people found in 500 meters of shore together and give this bigger picture, which may not have as much scientific detail in the individual site as a scientist, which I am trained as, would have. But it's the quantity of data in a snapshot, short period, which is incredibly powerful when put together with the more detailed information and more expensive technology, which scientists quite often use. So it's putting those two together and giving the citizen the feeling of, yes, I can contribute because I can understand now. And I can say, well, actually, for this particular patch, what you're saying doesn't apply. I wonder why not. Yeah. And it's the questioning and the empowerment, which is part of citizen science.
And it seems like part of that is bound to be about, you know, this word science that might seem like far away from me. But if you're in a garden, in a school garden, I know I've worked a lot in school gardens myself, and that, you know, what is the connection between the seed saving, the growing in the soil, or the marine mammals and science? It seems like it's this far away thing, but through that direct engagement, I imagine that there's a piece of that that's education, and it's a piece of it that's empowerment, of feeling like you can understand it at the level that you're working at it with. I don't know if anybody.
Totally.
Being able to understand the processes that you're observing. I think that gardeners are naturally curious people and love to experiment anyway, and sort of see like, well, what's happening here and what's happening there, and always want to know a little bit more about why and what's happening, and sort of expanding that, like you say, then to the wider, well, why are the seasons changing, why are my crops not doing so well this year as last year. Really, really good people to use as a barometer for what's changing.
Because essentially you were talking about the very first impetus to starting in the Lavar Loch was observation, which certainly is the key, you know, exactly what you've just said. People, if you're engaged in something, you're observing it, and you start to pay attention to seasons, or you pay attention to pollution in the loch.
And biodiversity as well. One very quick trick to do, even with yourself, is a patch which you walk quite often. You think, what animals are there, you know, on that shore? And sometimes I'm asking people, oh, you walk this shore quite often, you know, what kind of animals? That's just about nothing. Every so often there's a seal there. And then you say, could you fill out this form, but pretend that you are a sea anemone or a barnacle or whatever? So obviously you'd only be living in a certain place. and I give you 10 minutes, who can find the most, you know, a small group of people. Well, suddenly they're under stones and they're finding things they never saw. And it's this, you know, awakeness.
Different world.
Yeah. And then you realise it's a different world. Yeah. You know, I didn't see this before. Yeah. And that's really exciting for people too.
And once people do engage and understand, like you said, Jay, you saw change, you know, from the problems that were first identified and observed to now, what sorts of changes are you seeing in that and how are communities doing it?
Yeah, well, when I can only speak for myself. So when I came first back home, I was away for years. I was in New Zealand for years. But when I first came, when I came home about 7 years ago, like 8 years now, roughly, years are flying. When I did come home, the first thing I noticed, especially in Warren Point, was the amount of industrial waste lying on our shoreline. And I'm talking industrial waste now. Blue gloves, oil drums, fish mussel dredging nets, cages, all sorts of green string was driving me mad. And really and truly, I didn't know where it was coming from at the time because I just seen it. But I knew it had to be lifted up, and I knew there was nobody lifting it up. And I knew everybody was just walking on by in it. And I was afraid, I can only speak for myself, I was afraid myself of the kids beginning to think this was normal. Because the kids were seeing it day in, day out, and they were walking past it with their parents, and their parents were accepting it. So when the parents accepted it, obviously the kids accepted. So myself and a few others, we started the 2-minute beach clean. I don't know if you heard of the 2-minute beach clean. It was a great, great idea. A lad came up with it from Dorset, I think, or somewhere, Cornwall maybe he's from. But he came up with a 2-minute beach clean mindset. If you're going to do a clean up, just do it for 2 minutes each day and make a big job, a small job. And we started doing 2-minute beach cleans here, there. Olivia, one of the girls with Love Your Lack, organised for 4 2-minute beach clean boards to be set up. One in Warren Point, one with Strever, one with the Tidy Towns in O'Meath in County Louth, and one with the Tidy Towns in Carlingford. And that little networking together, you want to see the difference that made over the space of a few months. Now, it took us years, a year to get the beach clean board in with council and paperwork and insurances and everything. But once it was set up and once it was running, parents were down doing their 2-minute beach clean with the kids. Kids were doing it themselves. We couldn't keep people. And the difference, even today on the Warren Point Beach, I just checked it yesterday. And the difference on the Warren Point Beach was just, you know, the reward in it is something else. And it's a major, major difference. And that's just something so small and so simple, where citizens made the difference and played the part. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was just one little.
And you mentioned that the lock is, you know, that your community is all around the lock in both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah.
So that collaboration, was that important to looking at the whole lock as when we think about the fish or the seals you mentioned?
Yes.
Like they're not differentiating jurisdictions, so.
Yeah. Well, the way I looked at it is, somebody else brought this up to me, so it's somebody else's logic I'm using here, but it's a perfect. The way I looked at it was, like, if Carlingford Lock is a rubber band between Carlingford, Greenora, Carlingford, O'Meath, Newry, Warren Point, Restrever, Killone, Greencastle, Cranfield. And the way I looked at it is, if we have a problem on Warren Point, that's going to affect Carlingford. If Carlingford has a problem, it's going to affect Warren Point. If there's a problem in Restrever, it's going to affect O'Meath. So if there's a problem anywhere in the lock with pollution issues or environmental issues, it affects and concerns the whole lock. So I was under the mindset of thinking, it's no sense in us just fixing things here in Warren Point where there is a problem. We have to fix everywhere, because it's like a rubber band. If you bake a rubber band here, the whole rubber band is broke everywhere, and you need it working all together. So that was the mindset and the thoughts of including the whole Carling for Lack community and getting the Cooley, Gullion, Mourne community working as one. So that was the...
It's something that I've heard said a lot about community garden spaces is that they grow small amounts of food, but they grow a lot of community. And, you know, that ability to collaborate on shared problems and shared issues, it's not a skill that maybe everybody has. Is that part of the work of collaboration, you know, in resilience building and so on? Is that part of a key part of what you do with City Farms and Gardens?
Definitely. Like I like my particular interest is that that function of community gardens, that I think that they're sort of there's basic units of democracy kind of thing. It's like it might be individuals coming together, but whenever you're then in a community garden, then you're a group, and you have your group of people that have shared interests in, for example, your local environment or what's going on sort of in your neighborhood kind of thing. So people just sitting in their houses by themselves or working on their own private gardens, even though that's great, you're not having that shared experience with other people kind of thing. So I think community gardens are great for people to get together and talk about, what's happening with their local park, what's happening with their local river, what's happening with, like, you know, new roads being built through the area kind of thing, what effect that's going to have on their local environment. And they're doing it in a context of caring for the environment. Like the vast majority of community gardens, the people there have a strong interest in the environment. So people are always sort of like learning more about the environment at the same time and then starting to have opinions about things together. And I think then a really valuable thing that those people can do is start to then, as well as having opinions among themselves, then speak up to people in power kind of thing. So to sort of start to feed that information up, and that's a really valuable function of those groups.
Karen, what are the mechanisms? Because that's part of what you're trying to achieve, yes, right, is feeding it up.
Absolutely. I mean, just I was teaching in Hamburg University for a few years as well, and we were teaching architects and landscape planners and geographers biodiversity. And it's amazing because most of them had already done a master's or were in a master's program, so were really well educated, but done very little on biodiversity. And the projects we were giving them were interaction with community gardens and individual and streets, even to try and get a street to, which is I'm now trying to do in an EIP project, by the way, in Ballymoney in County Wexford. Get an area to all agree, not on a voluntary basis, not to use chemical sprays. And get a little sign to say, this area doesn't have them. You have a few community tools and you start hoeing outside your area instead of spraying Roundup, for example. Hmm. It brings the community together and it empowers, and you learn. You learn about pesticides, you learn about alternatives. And you start, I mean, the other brilliant thing, it gets your eye in on, and you learn the language. Botanical language is quite difficult. I mean, I think golfers also have a complex language. But you suddenly learn that language, and then the same people can also do fantastic salt marsh work, for example. Because the eye is already trained. It's like a lot of farmers, tillage farmers, I find, are really good as well to involve in projects, because they already have an eye for what might be a weed or what might be something else. So it's quite simple to then say, you might have this very rare plant in this area. Officially, it has been declared extinct. I think it might still be there. And did one like that in Banno Bay years back. Showed a picture of the wanted plant and just went to mass, to the different masses around Banno Bay. And the priest allowed it to be noted that this missing plant could be somewhere. And we found 7 sites of it. Mm-hmm. It had just moved because of climate change. Its original location was lower, and it had literally, as sea level is rising and rising more in the south than in the north, because Ireland is still tipping, it had literally gone on its elbows up, and we found it on higher ground. So that's fantastic. And that was total citizen science.
Yeah. And it brings us back, actually, to that importance of, you know, once you're engaged, you're observing. I think you had another story about farmers who, and it is interesting to talk about farmers because often they're seem to be set against, you know, biodiversity strategies or food production strategies or chemical strategies. But you had an example we were talking about before you came on the podcast about that observation of learning about rivers or learning about...
And nitrates as well. You know, if you're talking nitrates to a farmer who hasn't held a nitrate test kit themselves and done a simple field test, and field test before and after slurry test spreading, and actually understands, yeah, now I've done it myself and I know when you get a pulse of nitrates going down, that's far more powerful. Then, and a farm advisor, maybe as good as they are, they're only going to come once every whatever few months. But the farmer doing it themselves, that really empowers.
So it's similar across all of it, isn't it? That doing it ourselves. And
yeah.
I know the like your work, Karen, is across the island of Ireland. It's also across Europe. Is there... What kinds of the challenges that we face are pretty significant in terms
yes.
of what's going on in all parts of our land and our food system and our coasts and our rivers. What's your thought about networks and connections and collaborations as an island?
I think there's huge traditional knowledge around the island of Ireland. Absolutely enormous. You know, when I was meeting some of the Lough Foyle native oyster fishermen, how they managed the native oyster beds in Lough Foyle across the loch, agreeing, fine-tuning the season and the minimum size, depending on the joint pre-work they had done, is magic. It is so, and you know, quite often we think, oh, we've learned so much. And we forget this traditional knowledge, which is essential. And those with traditional knowledge have the problem that many systems are sort of half broken and what used to happen isn't happening or not at the time because of climate change. It's become more complex. But that ingredient, I know one of the fishermen I was looking for, the peppery furrow shell in mudflats, and I couldn't find it, and it's a really important indicator. So I asked one of the fishermen, and I drew a sketch on, you know, just on my hand, what the pattern looks like of the siphons on the mudflats. And he said, "Oh, the spidery thing." I never knew what that was, but I can show you where it is. And he showed me immediately. And the same with traditional gardening techniques. I mean, you probably know umpteen ways of dealing with pests and so on from yours, if you don't want to use chemicals.
Yes, for sure. And all that knowledge is there, and people are keen to share it with each other, which is important with all the networking. But as well, I mean, yes, traditional techniques are great, but also community gardens are great places for people to experiment and find out sort of like new techniques as well. Like new people love experimenting with Japanese knotweed techniques for managing Japanese knotweed, or people innovating, but like in a low tech way kind of thing. So like figuring out techniques that people can use and can share. But we did a really nice webinar a few months ago, and it was gardening techniques from around the world, and it was sort of looking at people who are living in Northern Ireland who come from other parts of the world and who have sort of brought some of their techniques and what's working here kind of thing. And there was a few different things that, yeah, it was really nice. But one of the nice things was that we had somebody from Nepal, somebody from New Delhi, and somebody from Pamplona in the north of Spain. And all three of them used Three Sisters techniques. So the Three Sisters is growing maize and sweet corn and runner beans or climbing beans, and then pumpkins or some kind of squash underneath, and those three plants sort of work together in a system to support each other in their growing. And I thought that was a Native American Indian technique, but it turns out that people have been using it for generations in the north of Spain and mm-hmm. Nepal. Like it's just a really common technique. So it's interesting to find things like that out as well.
And that kind of
polyculture type thing, yeah.
The idea of learning from each other, from new cultures on our island, and also like the lock on both sides of a jurisdiction. You have a project at the moment in City Farms and Gardens with working with the Republic of Ireland Community Gardens. And what would you say are the benefits of that? And is there how did it come about, or why did you decide we could be working in an all-island project?
Well, we were just so pleased to have the opportunity to work with. So Community Gardens Ireland is a network of community gardens and community grown spaces in the Republic of Ireland. And then Social Farms and Gardens, which is my organisation, works in the UK, so like Northern Ireland, England, Wales and Scotland. But we'd always sort of been friends with the Community Gardens Ireland ones, and we had done shared events and tried to support each other because they're doing the same thing as us, kind of thing, just trying to build capacity in the sector. And like it's all about networking for us. It's all about like linking people up, because sometimes community growing can be, if you're the organiser, it can be a bit lonely because you're sort of just plugging away at your own site and trying to do your own thing. And then you meet somebody else and they've got all the same challenges as you and all the same problems. And you can just sort of talk to each other and be like, oh yeah, funding's a nightmare, volunteers, hard work, like, you know, the council, my God, kind of thing. So it's just really great to bring people together for that. So we were really, so then there was a fund available from the Community Foundation for Ireland and Community Foundation Northern Ireland. And it was just seemed like a perfect opportunity to actually do some work together. So we applied for it and we got it, which we're really pleased about. So we will be working on a few different levels. Both organisations have maps of the community grown spaces. So we want to sort of try to bring those maps together, but also to bring some interesting elements in, like having, you know, if you click on a project on the map, you can see a video of that place and sort of see some of the things that they're working on. We also want to do some cross-border visits around different themes because we're always trying to share learning between community-grown projects in Northern Ireland, but then there's this just whole wealth of information of people doing stuff down south as well, like, you know, like beekeeping techniques. You know, there might not be so many examples here of doing it, or, you know, people might be thinking up really interesting composting techniques, but there's the practical skills, but then there's also the how do you work with your council kind of skills, how do you engage your community. And, you know, we've heard all of the examples from here, but then there's so many more ways that people are doing stuff down south. And then also just the organisations, Community Gardens Ireland is a brilliant organisation, what they've achieved. They're doing a really good job at the minute of interacting with like TDs and politicians and just talking about policy, like national policy around community growing. They have some really skilled people volunteering in their organisation at the minute doing that. So we're actually taking inspiration from them and looking at the reports and the submissions to government and the information that they're gathering to make a case for there being a legal obligation for councils, for example, to provide community grown space. So we're actually sort of going like, yes, we should do that. And we might copy your format a bit and, you know, just taking a lead from them. So, and hopefully we're also sharing some information about how we do things with them. So it's just a whole new wealth of information of how things are done. So, yeah, it's great.
I think there might be another aspect as well, which I've noticed. Sometimes when we invite people from the north to the south and they comment on something, then it is like an outsider commenting. Mm-hmm. And I remember Dr. Harry Gracie from Northern Ireland Agriculture came and visited us in Wexford, and I showed him some hedgerows, a neighbouring farmer, and he adored it. And he said to Kathleen, to the farmer, could I photograph your hedgerows to show at home? Well, she was so and rightfully pleased. And she said, this is good for Northern Ireland. So you can play it both ways. You can network, and you can also say, you know, those from across the border also think it's good. So it must be good. Yeah. And I think it sometimes works the other way too.
It does. Yeah, very much so.
You've had some seals crossing borders, haven't you, Shay? Do you want to tell us about what happened with the seal rescues on the loch?
Yeah, as I say, everything's new. So everything's trial and error. Just do it and find out. We don't know the protocols, or we don't know. Of course, we, as Carlingford Loch community, don't see the border. We don't recognise the border. We don't see it because nature doesn't. And unfortunately, now to the seals. But we had a few incidents. We're all trained up with Seal Rescue Ireland, and we were trained up in Quartztown and Wicklow. We're all seal rescue volunteers, so it's all on a volunteer basis. So, but we knew there was a place up in Portaferry that done seals as well. So they kept seals and showed seals off to the. But when we were rescuing the seals, the first few seals that we got in Giles's Quay, Green Nora, in the Cooley area, should you say, of Carlingford Loch, we were taken to Wicklow, because that's where we were trained up, and that's where we were set up and coming from. But we lived in the Carlingford Loch area. But as after a few seals, after maybe five or six seals, we caught on that the Strangford Loch facility would be closer for us in the Carlingford Loch community. But when we got a seal that was found in Carlingford and a seal that was found in Omeath, we were told in Portaferry, once we wanted to take it to Portaferry, that you can't take that seal here because that seal was found in County Louth. And we says, well, it's only a seal, like, it's, we're looking to save time. It's an emergency because they're pup seals, and time is of the essential. Once you take them from the coast, so we were told maybe five, six occasions that the seals found in Omeath and Carlingford and Cooley, Giles's Quay weren't to be taken to Portaferry. They had to be taken to Wicklow. So I think I have to say it was myself started coming up. And I just done it naturally. When I was picking up seals in Omeath or Carlingford, when the phone call was being made, we would phone Portaferry. And I'll just be honest, and I would say, this seal was found in Warren Point, or this seal was found in Restrever. So this seal was from the northern side of the world, and they would take it, so they would. So it was great that day.
So it's kind of a funny story, but on the other hand, there is opportunities, aren't there? And Karen, I think that's part of what the whole Coastwatch network's about.
Yeah.
Is about saying, in reality, if we're looking at biodiversity, if we're looking at practices for communities to take action, then we can do that from a community and a grassroots level without addressing jurisdictions and political barriers. You know, is that
yes, but it's not enough. Okay. I do think we need to call a spade a spade. When we have a loch agency, we have all the pieces there. We have a loch agency which goes across the lochs. But the loch agency doesn't have, in its terms of reference, protection of biodiversity.
Yes, this is the problem.
It is specifics like salmon, yes, mussels, no. Mm. And that needs to be changed. It really needs to be changed. It should have been there from the beginning, and now that needs to be amended. If we're looking at a climate and biodiversity crisis, then we have to, the communities can only do so much, but we need proper management plans across the two lochs. There's, I don't know, I've seen many areas, even like the Fete Noisy Glacé. This is a long, 20 kilometer long lake between Austria and Hungary. And when Hungary was still under communist rule, they still, that lake kept on going downhill because the two communities had different ways and each one distrusted the other and each one thought, look, it's going to go downhill anyway, so I might as well take a bit more. Mm. And then bottom up, through a Ramsa Convention movement, and WWF got involved as well, and bird people, they decided that they needed management. But they also were able to influence the top. And we haven't been able to do that yet. We have an all-island with grey zones when it comes to maritime spatial planning. We have a Loch Agency with no power over biodiversity. Their goal is not biodiversity protection, but it is aquaculture and tourism.
Yeah.
You know, this is like trying to walk on two legs, but one leg you have to hold up behind your back. No, isn't going to work. So I'm not faulting the Loch Agency. I'm faulting our ministers who haven't changed that yet. And I'm asking in this podcast, please, can you do this at your next ministerial meeting?
And if we're talking about the communities who are engaging with learning and maybe, like, I'm wondering, you know, if I was engaging in citizen science, for example, if I'm engaging in a beach cleanup or a community garden, I wonder, you know, my immediate need might be the interest, the enjoyment, but later perhaps, like you were saying, because you've learned to care about a piece of strip of beach or a particular community, that there is the part of, I suppose, getting involved at pushing for that. In what you describe in the example in Austria and Hungary, was that grassroots swelling of, so it's kind of these ingredients of knowledge.
Exactly.
Is that
it is, but also it's the luck of just getting the right people to come together at that time, for politician to take that extra step. They always know that there's a negative to whatever they're doing, but to be willing to go further. And then, you know, the Noisy Glacé, the way they shot ahead was incredible. They worked totally across. The Noisy Glacé is an absolute haven. It is well, well worth going to.
Yeah.
And all the produce of that area have way higher price because it is, a lot of it is biodynamic. It's managed really carefully. And so smaller amounts, higher quality, better for water, better for biodiversity.
I think that's like what you said, that like whenever there's a group of people, then you can speak on behalf of the group and then that has more power kind of thing. So like yes, getting involved in a group, over time you will be able, you will sort of care more. But I think also that there are just some people who just are able to link what's going on a small level to what's going on at a bigger level. They're able to sort of synthesize those ideas. But if they're just a person, then there's no reason to listen to them. But if they're speaking on behalf of a group, or if a number of groups get together, like all your towns around the lot kind of thing, then you have power basically, and they can't play you off against each other because you're coordinated sort of thing. So that's really important.
That's what happened with us. It was one or two people, mainly myself, giving off as an individual. But when we started talking as a group and as a community, politicians did pop up. And as I say, different little things. As citizens ourselves, we come across problems we don't even know there, and the problems are only arising on the ground. And they can be sorted out easy enough, quickly enough, when people have the will, and it benefits everybody. And as I say, the benefits for the whole community, clean water, clean environment, you know, a healthy wildlife is second to none. So as I say, is putting that onto our politicians who can make the difference at the top and make the changes. You were talking about Carnford Lock there. I would just like to say, Carnford Lock has no protections overall, management, protection plan, scheme at all. For an area of such outstanding natural beauty, you've got Cooley, Mourne, Gullion, and there's no protections of that area. It seems to be, if it's all been split up into little individual cases, I've got my pocket, we'll all make draw grants. But that's having a negative effect on the whole community. So there's politicians in there that can make changes on the ground, grassroots, and bring protections that are vitally needed to that area, you know. So,
and I suppose there is a connection, like you were saying to me again before we began, that you would like to do pretty much a tourism blurb now about Carlingford, telling people they should come there because you love it so much and you see the beauty in it. And that is a direct economic. So, you know, it's kind of that these things are not separate, that if you have clean beaches if you have, you know, had a conversation with, I think you talked about going to the source of where things were coming from.
Yeah, I don't like complaining about something if I'm not going to try to fix it or give it a good go at fixing it. And I like to go to source, you know, and I believe going to source in a nice way and finding the source of the problem, you can fix it without all the paperwork and all the PR and all the official stuff. You can, there's a whole lot of ways. Sometimes people want to help, and I don't know nobody that would say, ah, to hell with Cairn Fortlach. Everybody loves it. Everybody enjoys it. Everyone wants to be there. Everyone wants to. So there's nobody really in there that I could say that doesn't want to break it or doesn't want to fix it or doesn't want to protect it, you know. So it's a matter of just joining all them people up and putting them all together, thinking, change a little mindset of how long we can't keep taking from it. We can't keep wrecking it. We can't keep concreting into it. We can't keep polluting it because that's having a negative effect. We have to change.
I think sometimes the individual will have a negative economic effect. Mm. And to actually face that. But to say that overall the community gain will be much bigger. And that was also in the Noisy Glacé, Fetters Lake area, you know, where individual farmers were overstocking and polluting the lake. And they were saying, well, look, you know, this is the economic model which suits us. And for others to recognize that, you know, this is a big sacrifice for them because they are doing really well out of this. And to bring them around to that. And to help in the transition and not to be, you are so bad and blue, but to say, you know, up to now, everyone seemed to have been okay with it, but now it isn't and we're going to all pull together. And to involve the kids, which makes a huge difference as well when they get very proud and to make it possible for them to be green. Because aquaculture is another area which is very sensitive in the cross-border area and massive need. Massive changes are needed in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you talk about that transition, I think what you're talking about, and we've touched on it actually on other episodes of the podcast, about the just transition then, you know, so if it's not fair, if it's a burden to, you know, some sectors of the community and not to others, you know, it's like if there are changes to be made, how that justice element comes into it. I know at a grassroots level in community gardens that there is often an aspect of equity and equality, you know, being because it's somehow a level playing field, I think, a garden.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if that's
and
something.
A community garden, particularly.
Is that something that you've come up with or come about?
I mean, like, yes, for sure. I mean, most of the people that I know that are involved in community gardens would be sort of interested in sort of democracy and making sure that things are fair, making sure that people are welcome in their gardens. But I think you mentioned earlier that, like, I don't know about other parts of the world, but that in Northern Ireland there's a bit of a divide between sort of producers and farmers and environmentalists. And sometimes the two sides of the conversation not understanding each other or possibly deliberately being pitted against each other, I'm not sure. But and I think it's a really important issue to try to address and try to understand each other and understand that, that people need to be able to make a living, and farmers and I'm sure fishers as well have been put under so much pressure recently with being messed about with subsidies and putting working under a capitalistic model where you're just put under so much pressure to produce with no other concerns. And I suppose it's not their fault, it's the system that they're working within, and just I suppose recognizing that. So it's good to have conversations around that kind of thing.
And it's similar with knowledge, isn't it? That the siloing or the capturing of who gets to have access to knowledge, and I suppose that brings us back to the citizen scientist, you know, contributing to this picture that we need. And yet there are
huge difficulties in this area, and that's why I think this initiative, this All Ireland initiative, is brilliant, because we have to talk. You know, you can have knowledge, and then you can see incredible willingness to participate, to go out of your way to help. We found invasive alien Sargassum muticum, Japanese seaweed, resting on seagrass like a blanket in one area of County Wexford last summer. And the amount of people who helped, a guy with a drone, yes, we'll do drone footage. Well, I have no budget, we didn't get anything. That's fine, I'll just do it. You know, the next, a fisherman came and gave his boat so that we could map it, get an idea of biomass and so on. Everybody will help. When frustration sets in, is if then you are in limbo, oh no, you can't just take that out. That's an invasive alien species. Mm-hmm. Make a method plan. Okay, I'll make a method plan. Nah, it's probably not my responsibility. Go to so-and-so, go to so-and-so, mm-hmm. go to so-and-so. But I've already been to so-and-so. Never mind, go again.
Get the run around.
Ah!
That's the thing, isn't it?
That is impossible.
It's like the bureaucratic structures, they don't always know, they're brilliant at what they do, but they don't always know the answers that the people on the ground can have, kind of thing. And there needs to be like two-way conversations between those two. And what you said as well, like people want to be involved. People don't just want to do their job and go home and watch TV. They want to be involved in their community and be able to like care for and steward their environment and contribute to their community and in environment and help to shape their environment.
Yeah.
Like that gives people meaning in your life, doesn't it? Yeah. Like it's really important for your well-being, I suppose. Yeah.
I hope I'm not cutting across you now, but just we are, at least in the Republic at the moment, just at this crossroads where we have a new maritime spatial planning law. Local authorities, when the section which deals with local authorities gets commenced later on this year, local authorities will suddenly have responsibility for 3 nautical miles out to sea. And the local authority planning law and so on is pretty democratic. So for the first time ever, we are freed from the 1933 Foreshore Act, communities can theoretically participate in shaping the protection of biodiversity and of heritage, traditional fishing, all sorts of other things in that area. And it's an enormous opportunity. Literally the first in 100 years.
In that webinar we did about gardening from across the world, the woman from New Delhi was telling us that there's a law in India where people living in forests have a right to contribute to the management plan of the forest, that it's actually written in law. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And there's the whole rights of nature stuff as well now that's happening.
Oh, there's some brilliant work. Yeah. Yes, FAO do fantastic work on fisheries mm-hmm. and seaweed harvest and so on as well. But we could miss that if we don't really grasp that. So at the moment we're asking government to consider making a DMAP, which is like a type of management plan for seagrass, because seagrass is so important for biodiversity, climate change, and it is not being most of it is not protected, or protected on paper, and then you try and just protect it in reality. So what is fascinating is that in Northern Ireland, seagrass is a priority habitat, and already has all sorts of management and so on. So we could literally dovetail two things together mm-hmm. and it would be just brilliant. And in the lochs, like in your loch, loads of seagrass being nibbled at by certain pressures. So it's a very exciting time.
It is. I'm hearing that while there's the frustration on the one hand to, you know, wanting the top-down elements to support that empowerment of communities as custodians, like your community is actively around the loch becoming. Like, this is our common loch and we want to be looking after it. So it is an exciting time. And I guess maybe one of the things is how that first level of I'm engaged, I'm doing something as a citizen, as a community member, I'm doing it with a group now, that opportunity to make maybe the next leap into I could genuinely contribute to a management plan mm-hmm. or I could genuinely, you know, actively do that. Is there something that's needed there, or is it something that's just a matter of putting together all these, like a recipe that's sitting ready to be made into something wonderful? Because it sounds like you all have pieces of this recipe.
Yeah, well, I can speak with our council in Uri, over the last 7 years, like they're just backwards. Right, I'm going to say everything. They just don't take into consideration. They have their own biodiversity action plan that they just introduced in 2018, and they're going completely against it themselves. I think there was instance of the council having to report themselves over disturbing badgers in Kilbroney Park and different things. But there is some small, slight changes in going up through the council with different councillors and different mindsets, taking in the rights of nature plans and different things. So slowly but surely chipping away at them and people around them and, as I say, getting that change that we want and making decisions that benefit all of us, not just a few. You know, very important, I think. You know?
And I think like that, I don't think people need trained up to have opinions on things. I think that there's so much expertise, and like in any community group, there's just different people will do different things, do you know, and just there will be sort of skilled people who have a background and been able to contribute to things like management plans, and they just will be there. And I think that it's more people feeling empowered to speak up, and
given those opportunities.
Yeah.
And learning as well internationally. Like, you know, in community gardens, you have huge expertise and a long tradition in coastal zone management and issues like that. Ireland is really back, right at the, particularly the Republic, sadly. And we need to learn from others. And also the excitement of what is happening. Like Alex was saying, what he's doing in Greece on seagrass and how we could work together. And quite often it's a mix of, it's like a minuet. A little bit is competition, a little bit is excitement as you find the same things. And that we need to, and now, you know, even with the Ukrainian crisis and the Syrians coming, all people coming in, they bring knowledge. And they can share that knowledge as well. And they will feel much better when they feel that they're bringing something to us too. So
it's probably true. I mean, in Ukraine, I think that that there's a lot more sort of practical skills and growing skills. Like, because we've lost an awful lot of skills here, haven't we? Like,
they're more organic.
And we have Ukrainian coast watchers, and the coordinators are thankfully still well. Mm-hmm. But under terrible pressure.
And I would like to say a lot of the people that come to our events in the events around Carnforth Lock are people that have come from different areas, different places, and they come and they appreciate the beauty and the love of it, and they're the most important people for me. Sometimes when people live there all their life and they're open the doors, they don't show the same. But it's when a new person comes to an area and sees and they're the ones that want to get involved, mixed, help and promote the area that we all do live in, you know, and I think it's very important, what, not only what they can teach us, but what we can teach them. And it's very, very, very important, you know, includes everyone.
So thank you all very much for joining me and having this conversation. We've really touched on many things about essentially the power of community and participation. But I think where we finished there was that we're talking about biodiversity, but we're also talking about the huge diversity of human experience across the world and what that can bring to our actions to try to address the multiple crises, but especially current crises in biodiversity on the island and food production and things that are very much of our topical conversation across the island in these times. So thank you all very much for coming along.
No, it was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good fun discussion.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Across Divides. Learn more about today's topic and find opportunities to get involved at icommunityhub.org. iCommunity is a joint initiative of The Wheel and NICFA and is supported by the Northern Ireland Department for Communities, the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund, and the Shared Island Unit in the Department of the Taoiseach.